Whoa, someone's in the house. What's going on here? Get on the floor, scumbag!
Ho, hold up. Jay, it's me, Santa Claus. Put down the gun. Just put down the gun. Okay, Jay, you are literally the only person your age that believes in me. You drank two bottles of Malort. So let's calm it down more than a little bit there, Chief. Jay, you are hallucinating all of this. The brownies that Steve sent to the Muskie shop for the holidays. Let's just say they had some fairy dust in them.
No way!
So yes, I am
Christmas.
In fact Tom Hanks dressed as Santa Claus, but you are a grown man in his boxers, higher than a Georgia pine holding a gun to my head.
I don't give a monkey's butt who you are. I'm gonna blow your head off.
Jay, I wanted to come down your chimney and spread holiday cheer. In fact, I would like to come down your chimney multiple times, but this Santa gig is a brutal schedule. All I want is one simple thing. Jay, let me know what would make your holidays bright.
Well, Santa Tom Hanks, I tell you what, I'm a big World War II buff. Could you tell me a story about when Elmer Jensen was back in World War II?
Okay, Jay, put the gun down, lay down by the fire, and I will gladly tell you all about Elmer Jensen and the Christmas of 1943.
Okay, wait, let me grab one of those tasty cookies first.
There he was, America's muskie fishing hero, Elmer Jensen. In those days, they called him the Wisconsin Death Machine. To the Germans, he was an invincible legend. He had over 4,000 confirmed kills, most of which he achieved with a Smitty file he fashioned into a trench knife. He was feared by his fellow allies and troops. To this day, the English lexicon is yet to come up with a word that captures the mention of his name to his enemies. On Christmas Eve, 1943, Elmer was in the Black Forest of Germany doing what he did best. He had racked up easily another 100 Jerry kills before the Krauts begged for a holiday ceasefire. While the other troops were happy for a rest, Elmer Jensen dreamed only of returning to the North Woods and his beloved muskies. His mind was filled with one thing. What would be the hot new muskie bait of 1944? A cedar stick with paint? A cedar stick with two hooks? A cedar stick with a blade? Oh my, the possibilities, well, they were endless. While the other troops sheltered under the guise of a truce, Elmer took aim on the dirty Nazi bastards that stood between him and his muskies. On Christmas Eve, 1943, Elmer stuck more Kraut bastards than a hog farm, making him a true hero for love, for country, for muskies. In his memoir, Elmer Jensen, an American muskie badass, he is quoted saying, "No Kraut was going to keep him from the muskie season opener, 1944. Jay, are you asleep? Okay, Jay, I'm gonna leave.
Get out of my house, Santa Tom Hanks, now!
Yeah, St. Germain Police, this is neighbor Wally. I'm gonna need an officer down here. My neighbor Jay's shooting a Glock into a snowman, screaming about Tom Hanks, Santa Claus, and the Nazis. I'm gonna need someone down here pronto.
All right, folks, welcome to the Muskie 360 podcast. Have you recovered from your holiday fever dream, Jay?
Steve, am I dreaming or is this really happening?
Boom, bang, boom, bang.
Oh, wow, what a night. What a night, Steve.
Oh, what
I'm still
a night.
I'm trying to shake it off. That was crazy.
Those kind of dreams will haunt you forever.
They will. Enlighten your life, too, at the same time.
You know, the thing I've been thinking about, where's Todd and Dave for the holidays?
I heard Todd and Dave are coming next week for the show.
Possibly,
yeah.
Todd and Dave are going to come down your chimney. Anyway. Oh, man, the comings and the goings at the Muskie Shop are slow this week. It is the holidays. You know it. We know it. Everybody knows it. So, a couple of new hoodies. You got the book. You got the River Run Chubby. And there's the new Fenwick Elite Muskie Rod. Talk
they're
about
just
that.
Starting to appear. We're just starting to appear. We're getting a few miles at a time.
So they got what? 8'6", 9'7", 6". Yeah.
Yeah, they're two-piece rods. They've got an unusual, like, there's this device just above the butt section that you basically unscrew and the thing comes apart and breaks down really nice securely. So haven't seen anything quite like that before. And yeah, they get a bunch of models.
Oh,
there's some
HMG
models coming too. Yeah, there's two of them, I think.
What do they break down to? So I'm curious for flying them. So if you're flying for a trip, what do they break down to?
Yeah, I mean, you take this apart, probably 8. You know,
what do you mean 8?
Because it's just above. Because it's just above the butt section.
Oh,
the
okay. So
it's just above the foregrip.
Okay,
is where it comes
so it's
off.
Not like in the middle or something, right?
No, it's not. No,
that's the one thing. So pike anglers, muskie anglers are flying. That's always the question. It's not something that's super prevalent, but I get asked that. You've been asked that. What's a fly-in rod, right?
Mm-hmm.
When will somebody do something that breaks down like 48 and 48 so you can get it on a plane? That's
the problem with the fly-in rods. Yeah. They have to be like under 5 feet, I believe. So
somewhere
there's
in
not
that
much
neighborhood,
out there.
Right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Other than that, Jay, how chilly is it?
How chilly? It's been extremely warm and there's no snow on the ground.
Isn't that crazy?
So,
is there open water or no? Is everything iced up?
No, everything's frozen. They're ice fishing. There's good ice, but I mean, literally, it hasn't froze for like 2 or 3 days. It's been warm at night. Get cold tonight. I mean, we're getting some flurries, but there's a good chance we're gonna have a brown Christmas. That never happens here.
Oh,
I'm telling you,
I can promise.
There's a really good chance,
buddy. I'm gonna have a brown Christmas.
It's supposed to be 40 degrees by next weekend. So yeah, the snowmobile trail situation is not ideal right now.
Well, what you got,
neighbor
do?
Wally's got standing water ponds in his. Yeah, it was before he called the police on me, so.
Have you been down to the Snowmobile Hall of Fame lately, though?
Oh, no, I haven't. Why?
Have we checked their website? Holy crap. Hold on. Snowmobile Hall of Fame. This is comedy gold.
Yeah. That's located just down the road here in St. Germain on Highway 70.
Oh, man. Snowmobile Hall of Fame. Let's look at some of the names, shall we?
I don't know. Okay.
It loads slow. Fantastic.
Inductive. Some of the Hall of Famers.
Well, the problem is they spell them wrong, right? So I go to the Hall of Fame, and we were looking at this.
What do they do? Did they invent snowmobiles, or are they like great riders?
No, the problem was we were looking at the people that are in the snowball.
Oh, the one guy. A famous like snow cross racer,
right,
which is like motocross, you know, on snow. And I think they spelled his name wrong. I'm pretty sure they did.
Oh, man, whatever. Moving it's on, I'm not gonna go there. I'm not here to
good news story.
I'm not here to be a butthole. But if you run that website, check things out. So it's like right down from the house. Russ Lemke, Jeff Ludwig. If you ever want to know where we figure out names to make fun of on the podcast, or like for, you know, Dick Stimpy didn't come from there, but pretty close, right? So
it's a hybrid name. Yeah.
It is. Yeah. You just go to the Snowmobile Hall of Fame and just pick guys that are high profile in the snowmobiling game. So it is what it is. It's ridiculous. Jay, the holidays are quickly approaching. What's funny, everybody else on the podcast, they've tapped out, right? It's funny. Jay, how much time have you spent with your son this week?
My new son?
Uh-huh.
Little to none.
Little to none. Jay is trying to evade taxes, so if anyone calls you enough,
it's like gambling debt, Steve.
Right.
I gotta
exactly.
do whatever
so
I
Jay,
can do. You know,
so if anybody needs adopted, call Jay. He's working on it. So we're doing a little bit of Q&A. It'll be a short one here, guys. It's ridiculous. Got family in town. It is what it is. Todd with 2 D's, right? Because that's how you spell Todd.
Right. That's the
if you spell with 1 D, your last name starts with a freaking whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Greetings, Steve and Jay. I have a few questions for you.
Hi, Todd.
Hello, Todd. Guys, you're helping me getting started, learning bait fish, blah, 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 blah. First question. Do you have any sources to learn more about gizzard shad, alewives, or other bait fish for the Great Lakes? We see a good handful of gizzards other than shad species. I don't know what that means. So he's got gizzards, gizzard shad, regular shad, and alewives and all this other stuff in the Great Lakes. Reference to other types of guides. It seems like musky guides are not going to really be dialed in right on the bait patterns as much. That goes back to, like, if you understand crappies, look at a crappie guide. The best people I know to find bait are the people who are relying on it financially, right? So what are striper guides doing? What are bait shops doing to get shad? Number two, I was dumb and bought a musky fly setup. I can't catch them conventionally, so why not make it harder? I have no clue what to do for flies or leaders. Do you make your own leaders, and what is your go-to setup? My go-to setup, I fish muskies on the fly rod 5% of the time, right? Things have to be gnarly when I do it. So I'm tapering my fly leader to the depth of musky. So I use 130-pound Grand Slam mono, hard mono. And if muskies are at 4 feet, I have 4 feet of leader on. If they're 2 feet, etc. You see what I'm saying? So my leader is tapered to the depth of muskies based on seasonality and patterning. You look at musky fly leaders, you'll see these extravagant things that taper from 100 pounds down to 25 or whatever it might be. Muskies can't see. Why are we doing that? It makes no sense. So from a fly angler perspective, why are we tapering this thing down and doing all this kooky stuff? Make a leader that is commensurate with the depth you're trying to target. So generally, I fish nothing but Rio float line. And if I need to fly this run 9 feet deep, guess how long my leader is? 8. So once you understand patterning and you understand where the fish are, I'll use a hard mono leader, which is super cheap to make. I crimp them onto my welded loop. And on the end, to switch flies, I use a snap. Everybody's like, fly line purists or fly fishing purists hate it. It works, and it works well, right? I'm not doing 43 blood knots down to 10-pound tippet, or I'm not doing all this kooky stuff. Why? If I control 5 miles an hour with a headlock that's 12 inches, it has 3 7-aughts on it, or 3 6-aughts, excuse me, with 80-pound braid, 130-pound leader, what does it matter? Why are we making it harder than it should be?
10 degree.
Yeah. Don't get it mixed up. Don't get it convoluted where you go, oh, wow, I have to make this really crazy because I'm a fly angler and therefore, no. Taper your leader to the running depth you need your flies at. I see the propensity for guys to run Bufords and all these articulated flies. My preference is running a sinking fly. So let me back it up. So let's say I know that they're shallow muskies, right? I'll run a 1 foot, 2 foot leader with a sinking fly. Well, the float of the line is creating buoyancy. So I can work that one to two column, right? If they're deeper than, I can work that based on the leader length that's crimped onto my welded loop, and I have a switchable thing on the end where I'm not fooling around every time. The more things you take out of your signal chain for a muskie, the better you are. Hard mono, tailor it to the running depth you need your flies at. I typically use a sinking fly, and guess what I do at sunset, Jay? I use a topwater fly, just like I'm conventionally muskie fishing, right? Something to think about. You know, another question, right? How do you run a beaver bait? Jay, you've filmed them.
Yeah.
Jay's a beaver master. Yeah, I've fished with him. I've caught fish. It's a jerk bait. What do you think with a beaver bait, Jay?
Well, it's cool when it recoils, you know, because the whole body is jointed and it's got a big beaver-like straight tail. Beaver, yeah. You know, doesn't have any curly grub type thing sticking on the end. It's just straight. So that thing's just kind of flapping up and down in the water. But when you stop it and surge it and give it little short pulls, not necessarily hard jerks, but short pulls, it coils up and then jerks forward. And it's actually, and the main thing with those is it's really going to be beneficial to add some weight to that. It is very slow sinking, unweighted. There's a weight system built in the head. You can screw in anybody's weight, you know, a half ounce, three quarter ounce, something like that on the say middle size beaver. They come in at least three different sizes. Would get that thing working so you can get that thing 4 feet, 5 feet down on a normal cast with retrieve speed. Yeah, they're cool. You know,
it's funny. Just changing the headspace to back to the fly fishing thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
A streamer surges forward and has rest. Surge, rest, surge, rest. A beaver bait does the same thing, right? Fish a beaver like you fish a streamer. If you have the brain for a fly fisherman, a beaver bait's in the same realm. And like Jason, you can weight them. You can use the same like phantom weights or whatever it might be in a beaver bait and get things done. So looking at a beaver bait from the capacity or the sense of it's a streamer. That's the way I look at that bait. It is a castable fly. It really is. Yeah. It's a double articulated castable fly. That's it. And people go, wow, that's amazing. That catches fish. And so if I'm fishing, say, a 10-inch beaver bait, and they're moving at a moderate speed with no weight, right, Jay?
Uh-huh.
They're coming up on this thing, and I'm working at 4 or 5 feet with a moderate retrieve. Well, it sounds that a 10-inch Buford might be the call, which is like going from a big crankbait to a big topwater, big blades to a topwater, right? Because a beaver bait is a double-articulated streamer at the end of the day, in my opinion. So if I'm moving fish on flies or whatever it might be, the beaver bait's the only time. That's the only time it really comes into play for me. The way, if you look at that, that's a couple articulated sections tied to plastic, right? Where a Buford or a Sculpin head on a fly is a tied hair, tied whatever you got, with a plastic articulated head, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you see that multiple joint, you go, whoa, break them down for what they are. So I think the beaver bait is interesting because like a bulldog works in that down up methodology where a beaver bait works in the same nature, a little more straight though, right? So it's hard to get a beaver bait to kick left to right than is say a bulldog. But they're very much in that flappy up and down, you know, tight wave motion, right? So this guy's asking about fly fishing. Start with beaver baits, and if they're moving on those in the shallow, rip them like a streamer. Pull, stop, pull, stop, pull, stop. You can translate that to your fly rod for whatever it's worth. His last question.
I think what it's doing is just displacing water. It's not always as much noise. You know, it's pure water displacement. There's a big, big profile with your average, whatever beaver size you go with. But and same thing with flies. You know, it's not rattling and squawking and spinning and gurgling. It's just displacing water. And sometimes that sounds real to them, you know?
I mean, if you look at, say, a bulldog, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, same. Right.
A bulldog and a streamer are not that different.
Hmm.
Pull, pulse, pull, pulse. A great streamer in fly fishing falls at acute angles. So when you break down your fly equipment, if you're doing it, if you're thinking about it, we're looking for flies that fall off at weird angles on the pulse without stress in the front. It is what it is. Okay. His last question, Jay, and you have to answer this, right? This is geared towards you. Are you ready?
I was sure.
Does Jay smell nice?
Do I?
Yeah. What do you think?
100% all the time. Are you kidding me? All the time.
What's your hygiene routine?
I really don't want to go into this, Steve, but it's a multi-step process each and every day. Throughout the day.
All day. Throughout the day. Mark.
Yes.
You've been discussing a lot about how sight and vibration affect a muskie and how it feeds. What role do you believe that scent plays in enticing a bite, and do you add scent to any of your artificial baits or presentations? Whether open water, ice fishing, love the podcast. Thanks, meow. Well, Dr. Juice has been a constant source of Pavlum on the podcast.
Yeah, it kind of has.
We always love to rip on Dr. Juice. Oh, man. I don't think about sin at all. I don't. Because it seems like lateral line, visual, scent would be a third thing. What if you have the wrong scent, right?
Yeah.
Like, where do you go? So we're doing everything right, but the third component being scent, and they pick it up at the end, they go, whoa, whoa, whoa. No. Bad, right?
Well, yeah. I can see one benefit possibly being masking human scent. Haven't found that to be any kind of issue. Not that I've done extensive research on it or anything like that. But, you know, I mean, you get bug spray on or something like that. Gets on your lure. Obviously, if you're walleye fishing, you don't want that.
Right.
That's more or less proven. Muskies, don't know.
I mean, I slather with not sunscreen a big factor every day with me. And I touch bait. I don't think it matters entirely. Mm-hmm. If we knew beyond a shadow of a doubt, running depth, seasonality, size profile, like we get in the hierarchy of musky stuff, you could theoretically drill scent. It's going to be at the very end of the hierarchy.
I mean, right? Perhaps in a very, very dark water situation, right, where their senses are more in tune with scent than they normally would be in a clear water situation, mm-hmm, you know, it maybe has some kind of impact. But again, what if it's a scent that is going to turn them off?
Well, there you go. I mean, how dialed in are you?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I touch baits with sunscreen. I'll eat a turkey sandwich or I'll scratch my head. I mean, you're introducing scent in some capacity to your baits nonstop, right? So you pump your gas, you put your hand sanitizer on, then you touch your first bait, you're introducing scent.
We got a load of lures from a manufacturer I'd rather not mention the other day, and Jim walked into the office and grabbed the Glade,
mm-hmm,
and started spraying the entire aisle. We introduced scent to the musky shop just the mm-hmm other day by opening a box of fresh bucktails.
Right, which is, well, think about that, right? Let's take a bait, and it's in someone's home, and they're a smoker.
Well, this one smelled like a dead skunk, but yeah, right.
Well, a dead, right. They're a smoker. Toke it up, boys. So you add a little skunky skunk to it, right? You pack your bowl, and then you make your baits. And then they end up at the musky shop, and they glade them. And they end up in the back of a FedEx truck that is full of Roombas and Glade and T-shirts from China, right? Mm-hmm. They end up in a USPS truck, and they end up in your mailbox. And your mailbox is who knows? And they end up in your hands, and you just ate your KFC, right? And you're excited because you got your musky shop package, and then you touch your musky shop bait and you take out the plastic thing, you go, wow, this is gonna catch a hog, and you put in your tackle box. There's a lot of stages where oils and solvents and all these things are introduced into that bait.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, I don't know of a bait that is manufactured and or made in a you know, clean setting. You know, Titans probably smell like noodles and soy sauce. I don't know. Right. So how would you descent a bait and start at zero? Could there be a scent on a bait that is a deterrent is the next question. That opens Pandora's box of going, you know, is there, let's say we're throwing double eights, right, Jay? Mm-hmm. Is there something on a pair of double eights that is a deterrent versus you grab the same color, the same blades, the same everything, you retrieve it the same way and it gets eaten? Was there a scent deterrent over an attractant? That is an interesting premise. Which you said, you know, so the Muskie Shop, you house the vast majority of baits that ever are introduced to a Muskie Angler's tackle box, right? Freddie goes downstairs and Freddie eats two Totino's pizzas for lunch, right? And there are oils that are on your bait that smell like Parmesan and pepperoni, right? Mm-hmm. Do you know that? No. Do they disperse in the water? Do they, like, are we, here's a weird question and something to think about. Do we take a bait out of the package brand new because the person in China that makes a Titan or a Kraken or a Kamikaze or whatever, right? They just ate salmon, sushi, and they touched the bait, and we gotta get those oils off the bait before it's productive. I mean, scent goes so many ways in this crazy land stuff, right? Like, ugh, like horrible. Now, one thing I'll say is this, is Booker did an article years back where he, I'll get him on, we'll talk about it. He peed on a bucktail, right, and caught a fish. He dipped a bucktail in gasoline and caught a fish. And he poured like Coke or something on another bucktail and caught a fish. Made no difference, right? Because it happened so fast that they're not tasting. So, the argument could be made: are your baits contaminated before you throw them? I believe they are. I've never thought about it, but I believe your baits have oils and scent on them. Because let's think about this, right? So I'm picking on myself, so I'm not picking on somebody else. A Titan is molded in injection mold, right? Boom. Well, the first matter of the business is the wire is bent on a wire form, and someone takes the wire form and they put it on an assembly line, right? They've touched the metal. Well, when you touch something, Jay, what do you leave behind? Oil, which is fingerprints, right? So you watch Forensic Files. Fingerprints are oil and some excretion of your skin, correct? So we've introduced smell number one. We actually, you know what? Start before that. The wire, which is 055 or something, whatever it is, comes from a place that made the wire and someone bundled them, right? Touch number one. Touch number two is the person that does the wire forming and they go into the injection mold. Touch number three is the person that takes the bait out of the injection mold. Touch number four is the person that does the base coat. Five is the person that does the overcoat. Or not overcoat, but the paint. Six is overcoat. Seven is somebody's doing hooks, right? Eight is the person that does packaging. Nine is the person that receives it in America, opens the package, inspects it, puts it back in the package, sends it to the Muskie Shop, and you guys touch the box, right? Ten hands have touched it before you've even thought about getting it. It goes on the shelf.
And it saturates in a container for a month.
Which is a
God knows, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Next door could be fertilizer or freaking computers. We have no clue.
Right.
So we have 11 points of scent introduction. Point number 12 being they arrive at the Muskie Shop. John, Jim, Jay, Tom, somebody takes out the package and Jay ate a hot dog, a glizzy that day, right? There's 12. Then it goes on the shelf or goes in storage. 13, somebody picks it. 14, Rick touches it. 15, it goes in a box. Then it's in a container to get to your local area. You see what I'm saying about? Probably by the time you get that bait, 17 points of contact have happened that get introduced smells. Which is a whole other crazy factor. I've never said it out loud. Am I sounding stupid? I'm just riffing. I've had like 9 Pepsis. But at that juncture, 16, 17 points of contact. And now you open it, right? And you just had 15 Coors Lights and a Little Caesars pizza, right? And you take it out of the box and go, wow, I love it. Should we, as musky anglers, sanitize our baits? I don't say sanitize from a germ focus. Is there an argument to be made that we should clean a bait off? Interesting topic, right? Should you take a bait, use rubbing alcohol or something of that nature to take off whatever scent was introduced, because those oils will be introduced into the water column in some capacity based on how prevalent they are on that bait.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Never thought about it. It's stupid. I don't think about it. I don't think it has a lot of weight, but could it play? Right. Is there a great way to check that? No. But you think about, let's take, again, I'm picking on myself, so I'm not doing anything else. Right. Take a Titan out of the box and you got a hot fish and you take it out of the box and you throw it in front of a fish and he comes in and he starts doing that tasting stuff. Whoa, something's weird. Right. Because that bait was shipped next to, you know, freaking aluminum dust for industrial sanding. You don't know that. So it's something to think about. Does it play in my brain? No. Do I think about it? No. Do I clean my baits off? No. If you're hypersensitive or hyper thinking about scent, I would start at ground zero. So the only way to truly understand if scent plays, right, would be to take a bait, remove all of the oils from it, and introduce it to actively feeding muskies that you know are hot as they can get, but they won't eat, and they introduce scent and see if that closes the gap. So we understand seasonality, staging, right? Feeding windows, what speed they want it, what depth they want it. We're going down the list, right? And now we know our bait is completely free of exterior contaminants, and we have introduced a scent. So Jay said somebody delivered a bunch of bucktails that smelled like the skunk. Yee yee. Right? So they got a little 420 blazing on them. And there's a little glade on them. Well, does that matter? What do you think? I'm just riffing, dude. I'm just talking to my ass because I'm thinking out loud. I go, does it matter? Could scent matter at slower speeds? Could there be, let's say you bought a bucktail, right? And guys, I mean, I'm not picking, I talk about the shop or I talk about my baits, so I'm not talking about somebody else because it's across the board, right? We don't know. It's an interesting concept, Jay. So I'll pick on Booker baits because he won't get mad at me, right? So you buy a shallow raider. Right. How many of you guys sold a blue billion of them? Right. 5-inch shallow raider in whatever car. How do you know the guy that didn't put that in the package wasn't wearing CK1 by Calvin Klein because he was living in the 90s? And that was the he sprayed it in the car. Right. Came into work. And that was the first bait he packaged that day. So it had a high density of oils from perfume on that bait. You don't know that. Does that change the bait? Whoa. All right.
Okay. Well, how about this? What about noisy baits versus silent baits?
No baits.
Silent. Silent meaning non-spinning, non-clacking, non, basically non-vibrating, but you know, like beavers,
right?
Like Medusas. Something that's just pure dispersal versus noise.
What I'm putting in everybody trying
and
to
slower.
Are
they going to tune in more?
What I'm trying to convey to everybody is if scent, I'm making scenarios that are shitty to go, whoa, question it, right? However, at that point, if we're dialed in, we are beyond dialed in, if that matters, right? However, I'm looking at my line of crane baits, right? I told a great client of mine, Jason, this week, we both fish Eagle Lake. I've taken him up there, what do you want to call it, right? Where crane 207s are the jam a lot of times. And I will have the one bait, the bait that is just catching the crap out of them, right? And I give a client or I give a friend or whomever the same color, which is the basic crane, cream and brown, right? So it's like a Model T. You can get it any color you want as long as you want cream and brown. We have the same bait. We have the same hooks. We have the same everything. And one's getting lit up, one's not. Could you question scent at that point? When we're down to the nitty gritty, it's a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
You know, am I there very often? No. We're past call or we're down the rabbit hole. It's kind of fun to think about. Do I personally think it matters? No. Have I put sunscreen on, smeared it on my face, smeared mm-hmm, it on my arms, mm-hmm. picked up a bait, and then 5 minutes later caught a fish? Bam. Absolutely.
Well, look at it this way. What if scent, especially on noisy baits like bucktails, you're talking about what Booker mm-hmm. did. What if it's a positive thing? It's just adding to this unnatural, noisy thing that strikes their curiosity and switches them on.
You have to be, like I said, you have to let's say Wildcat Lake, right? Gun mm-hmm. to the head, I'm going to go Wildcat. If I have to catch a musk, a lunge, is it going to be big? No. Is it going to be even legal? No. Could you play that game there? Yeah, probably.
Mm-hmm.
But do you want to put the time in and go, you know, Dr. Juice Classic versus Dr. Juice Musky Pike versus pouring a Coke on it versus rubbing it with a T-bone steak? What does it matter? Now, the other question being this, does the colder the water, now this is a whole other animal, and I could probably work on it. I might try it because I'm literally in real time thinking through my whole thought process here. So right now I'm looking, Jay, at typically 48 to 49 degree water temps, right? Okay. I get deep follows on Panoptics. I get them coming in and looking at live bait. I get them doing different things. If I introduce scent, would it close the gap?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Would that follow convert into a strike in cold water because the molecules are moving slower, right? And what I'm getting at is this, boil a pot of water, right? All you're doing is speeding up molecules, blah, 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 blah. So in colder water, that scent is disseminating less than, but it's tighter to the bait. Would it close the gap? Would it convert a fish? The problem being in musky fishing, you never know for certain, because if you catch a fish a day, you're doing great, right? However, scent, theoretically, could be the final level of attractant or deterrent. So, you know, for me, I'm sitting here looking at my bait wall going every day, in the bait cave, right? There's one of the Glade things that's on a timer, and I have a heater, and I've got this, I've got that. Should you clean your baits off or not? Should they start at a baseline of no scent? Ah. Interesting topic, I think, where I think no matter what, though, you're introducing scent to baits at all times. The second you touch them, oil is introduced, right?
Yeah.
But should you, say, take rubbing alcohol and clean a bait off before you add it to your collection? How do you know where it came from? Is what I'm getting at with the whole thought process. Right? You don't know if the guy that drove the FedEx truck from Illinois to, you know, to Indiana, what was in that truck. Doesn't matter. I don't think it matters, but it's valid. You know what I'm saying? It's valid because you're not at this point of fresh start in a scent perspective where visually, brand new bait, you know what you're getting. Action-wise, you know what you're getting. Scent-wise, you have a ton of things that are introduced to that bait in some capacity that you have zero control of. You know, to keep hitting it, take a deer hair bucktail, Jay. Okay? If we're thinking about scent and we're really thinking about it, dudes, right? What part of the deer did it come from?
Good point. Yeah, and it stinks.
And it stinks.
It does.
You're closer to the glands. Guess what that deer hair smells like? You're farther away from glands. You take it off a back strap, it's nearly scentless. You take it next to an anal gland, it smells like beehole, boys. Right? I mean, what do you think? Okay, I'm not trying to be vulgar in any capacity, but there's a lot of bucktails that are made out of the white part of a white-tailed deer. Correct, Jay?
Yeah.
Well, what's that next to? Their beehole or their vajayjay. That's the best I can say on the podcast. Right? Mm. Well, what a deer smell in the rut. Some secretion from a female deer. You're telling me those oils, that secretion is not on the white part of a bucktail that doesn't end up on your MEPS musky killer. Wrong or right? Am I wrong or right, Jay?
I seen a 85 pounder once and inhale a whole eight pointer one time on Wildcat.
I mean, Musky
buddy told me that.
Musky
one.
Buddy. I know. No, I'm mean, down the rabbit hole.
They'll feed on deer.
It makes sense, though, right?
What about hard baits?
I know. I mean, I'm down the rabbit
hole. Hard baits, sometimes they will stink of paint and clear coat.
Oh, dude.
They just do.
They just stink like, again.
Smells like chemical.
Epoxy reeks.
Yeah.
I've been higher than a freaking kite in my garage. When I was making like original Titans or like Krakens, I come in the house and go, you know, you're 10 beers deep and you just inhaled epoxy for 4 hours. You don't know what the hell's going on, right? Again, I think the fun thing about musky fishing or the fun thing about these questions is thinking them through, right? Where, you know, I'm not saying the deer hair on a MEPS is going to be this or that or the other, but there's the distinct possibility, right? Maybe they go through a bleaching process or a cleaning process or whatever it might be. You're introducing smells. If your tackle box is in the, I mean, leave a Sonic freaking drive-through bag next to your tackle box and it's going to stink like a freaking double cheeseburger, right? So I think what's neat about this, and I think about it often, and I'll just shut up after I say this. Should we clean our baits off? Should they start at net zero so there's no influence negatively or positively before we make a judgment call? How can you make a judgment call? Because to say, so let's say Dr. Bob, right? Dr. Bob is a great dude. He has a great article on the app this week. So he actually came up with a custom formula, Jay. A custom formula for reeling speed.
The reels? Yeah.
So check that on that. But let's say Dr. Bob, and he's not a smoker, but let's say he is, right? And Dr. Bob smokes 2 packs of marbles a day and his tackle lives in his boat. Is his tackle influenced by the oils residue left by cigarettes? Yes or no? Absolutely. Correct? I mean, Jay, yes, no. I mean, it has to be.
Has to be.
All right. So if Dr. Bob's a smoker and he smokes two packs of Marlboros, and his tackle lives in the back of his car. There's a cigarette smell on those baits. Is he less effective or more effective? We don't know. If he had, quote unquote, hermetically sealed baits in a Johnny Carson kind of way, but if he had baits that were completely free of scent, would he be more apt to catch muskies? Yes or no? We don't know. That's where I'm circling back to. If he had baits that were completely clean and Wiener introduced Dr. Juice to them, would he be more successful or less successful? Right. Now, you're going, Jay, you're begging for me to shut up. I apologize, right? Here's
what I'm just thinking about.
Yeah, thinking about, right? So, here's where I'm at. Somebody might be really good at scent or have a great theory or a synopsis of this. I'm not the guy. I'm just telling you what the logical thought process is. For a lot of years, you know, I don't fish out of the back of the boat anymore because I've been hooked so many times, so I fish out of the nose. Most of the time, I run my boat backwards, right? But it keeps people from, like, putting the rod near me. But a lot of years, I fished out of the back of the boat with two strokes. When you stop a two stroke, what do you see in the water, Jay?
Mm-hmm.
You see that rainbow. You see that, like, dirty
oil. Yeah, that oil. Oily.
Every time.
You get the smoke, too.
Yeah, you get the smoke and you get the oil. What's coming out of your engine? The exhaust from an outboard comes from the prop hub area, right? It comes out of the frickin' the prop.
Mm-hmm.
And I caught a lot of fish out of the back of a boat. And I put, like, if I have one client, guess where he's going? The back of the boat. It's the best place to fish for muskies. You're lowest to the water, right? You have the biggest platform, yada, 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 yada. And scent for me has always become a matter of, well, four stroke, two stroke, nose stroke, I don't care what stroke it is. Your exhaust comes out of the engine. That's got to be far more overpowering than anything we can introduce to a bait. I don't know, Jay. I mean,
well, we'll see, because I guarantee you're going to get some people that are going to email and contact you that say,
yeah, I love it. Yeah.
They use Ziploc bags and they soak their baits, you know, especially.
And they fish with the engine trimmed up.
Yeah. And they put in a special scent that they manufactured or purchased or whatever. And it's just like, I always catch fish on them. It's like, that's great. But Booker dipped his bucktail in gasoline and caught a fish on it.
Little bit of pee-pee.
He did
the Book Daddy wee-wee, we called it.
If it is scent, what is scent? What is scent? What is positive and what is negative?
Sometimes people want to pee on your trailer, Jay. Anyway.
I heard.
Yeah. You know, we got a pee-pee bandit. Wait till the cops show up. It's... Again, we're riffing, and I hope in your guys' minds, where I don't have the idea on this. I love it. I love the doing this. Me and Jay talk like this quite often. Okay, so you said Joe did the breakdown that, right? We don't know Joe's seasonality. Okay? When did that happen? Did it happen in June, July, August, September?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, follow.
Whereas Andrew Walker from Cast and Conquer in Canada, friend of the podcast, said that if he can't fish live baits for muskies under the ice, which that's closed, by the way. But when he could fish muskies under the ice, he had to have a fresh bait that had a scent.
It's true.
The argument being, could you get away with being a cigarette smoker? Your tackle, you're throwing your old Taco Bell bags on top of your tackle boxes, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're throwing your grease gun on top of them and you're pulling 5 feet from your spot in the summer, but you're burning blades and catching fish. Is scent less of a factor than, hey, I got a low and slow a pounder off of a sand flat in gin clear water with little to no motion? Would that guy be successful? Right? So, muskies are on pounders. They're in clear water. There's nothing sort of creating turbulence. If that same cigarette smoker, fast food eater, grease gun layer I'm talking to you, Josh Hackensmith. Right? He's going to laugh, right? Josh Hackensmith, forklift certified, right? I'm thinking about the guy that's going to smoke cigarettes, throw a grease gun on top of his tackle box and Taco Bell. And right, it's Josh Hackensmith, and I love him. But if there's going to be the introduction of scent to a bait in cold water, does it matter more? I don't know. We're talking about it. It's fun to talk about. Jay, I'll shut up. I'm sure you're dying for a new move on, right? Mark, you've been discussing a lot about how sight and bite. Oh, that was the other one. Been drinking, Jay. Been drinking. My apology. Let me scroll down. Thomas, Stephen, I just want to tell you how much I enjoy your podcast. I look forward to it every week, and it's part of my routine. And the cover songs are great. I laughed out loud with the emo songs this week. I appreciate you guys keeping my head in the musky game. Thanks for everything. Thomas, God bless you. Goose. Hey, Steve. I'm reading them in real time, folks. Hey, Steve. I've been musky fishing a local lake and spillway on, not going to say what lake it is, having a hard time catching fish, thinking mainly just low population. The lake you're talking about, they put a bunch in there, so you got a decent population. And high pressure. Yes, there's pressure on that lake, right? I was thinking of trying the other big lake in my state. Yes, which is the Muddy Lake. I've never tried it before, and pointers would be really appreciated. Thanks for all you guys do. Love the podcast. Let's do it weekly. It's the only good thing about Monday, LOL. Jay hates Mondays. So, Goose, the lake you're talking about, guys, I'm going to burn this, but the lake you're talking about, let's look at the spillway below it. Right down the 12 pole. So there's a lot of communal water there. There's a lot of small fish, but there's a ton of fish between the freaking dam and 12 pole. Okay. Far less pressure. That lake is notorious for guides that don't have their captain's license or pay insurance. So therefore, they stay off that water. So the lake is navigable water. Also, is the outflow between there and 12 pole. But most will stay off of it. It's tighter. It's a little bit more volatile, but you will find fish there this time of year. That's an interesting facet. Aside from that, you will find fish. It's crazy. Up until mid-December, we'll hit blades on that lake because of the water color. Okay, so when you add seasonality, we're always thinking deeper, 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 but it's like comparing stats, right, Jay? Jay can run X, Y, and Z miles an hour, but if he's got a tailwind, he runs more. It's just statistics. So The more turbid, more tannic, more stained, more muddy, Goose, your water is, the shallower fish will be. So don't overthink it. So take a little bit away from this scenario, the more muddy your water is. Check it out from the dam to 12 pole and let me know how you do. If nothing else on that question, you can always email me and we could do a little private chat or a private email. Try to help you the best I can. Casey, hi. If you're up for this question, it's unnecessary. I understand. No question is stupid. No question is unnecessary. My kids and myself have never caught a muskie. I've been looking around for muskie gear, and prices are high. Can you recommend a combo that is in the price range from $100 to $200 or lower? Thank you for your insights on Muskie 360 Network for beginners like my family and myself. And this guy's in Des Moines. He's Des Moines, Iowa. Hold on, Jay. Whew, gonna be tough, Casey. Okay, rods and reels. Cheapest reel, Jay. Let's look.
Well, there's round reels like the Abu Garcia C3s are probably about 120, 130.
Okay. Yeah, it's 150 now, which is nuts. Those used to be $75. So 150 there. Cheapest rod. Bulldog Predator rods used to be $100. And in protest, Jay, you know this, right? I used to fish a $99 Bulldog Predator rod because I was being ridiculous. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Cheapest rod that I would recommend. This is going to get her done. Let's look.
Oh, Akumas are.
That's what I think. That's where I'm going. Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
It's.
Get an extra heavy.
So we have The Akuma EVX B series, 129, right? Cool. Great. Could you buy an Akuma rod? And let's say, Jay, I never want to take away from Muskie Shop, but let's say money's a problem, right? Could you theoretically buy a 300 series bass reel? This is the biggest reel you could get and get away with it. Yes. Could you theoretically buy a used reel? Yes. So backbone, reliability, fixability, you could go with a C3 and a Akuma and you're going to be fine, right? Cheapest low profile reel. Let's look. Reel and reels.
Max 4. Gotta be. Yeah, boo.
Let's look.
Like 180?
Pin. Oh, no. Okay. I had some of these back in the day, and you know what? We don't have them right now, but if you need it right now, you could find it if you had to. The Shimano Corvallis. $89, dude, right? The cheapest, this is blowing my mind, Corvallis, followed by the C3. These are the cheapest reels, period. We get into anything else, because the Daiwa Tatu, if you see on the side, it's a 100 size. It's a bass reel, right? The Max 4 low is 179.
Right, right.
So 179 and 129, we're at $300, which is not the $200 budget, but that's reality. It's just reality. Muskie fishing has never been cheap, and I don't think it will ever be cheap, right? But that would be some ways to look at it.
Another thing to do, I think we've got C3s with shield rods.
Yeah, there's combo.
And the thing is, you'll probably have to have it shipped.
You're going to save a couple bucks.
Shipping's expensive, but, well, yeah, you save like $45, you know, because they'll ship free. So,
all the combos, doing, yeah. You could do it with a C3. C3's got a thumb bar. You know, like I said, I mean, my dudes, it grosses me out. It just does. Okay. C3 combos, $339.98, Jay.
There you go.
You know, he's saying $200 though. I'm just being realistic. Yeah, you're gonna
line and leader too.
Yeah, you're gonna have to. You could do that. Well, that's the other thing though, because you could get the Akuma and a C3 or the 300 size bass reel, and you're still got to do braid, and you still got to do leaders.
Then you got to get leaders in line. Yeah, free line leader with a combo.
Right.
You got a lot of different combos.
That's a way to skin the cat. Look at this low to high. Let me say this. I'm going to preach for 2 seconds, Jay. I've said it on the boat, and I feel comfortable saying on the podcast that nobody will get mad at me, right? When you see the pricing that is coming down from manufacturers for 2024, you're going to be shocked. You're just going to be shocked. So if you need something now, before the end of January is the time to do it. Is that a safe statement, Jay, and that is okay to say?
Yeah, we're resetting the store now. Been doing a lot of work on that this last week, so stuff's starting to go up. Not everybody's increasing their prices, but there are several manufacturers that had like pretty significant
shockingly,
jumps.
Yeah. In my opinion, for what it's worth.
Yeah.
I'm just saying what I think, which is that's a mild version of what I think. But
it is what they charge.
It is what it is.
What it is.
Can't control it. But that's way to skin the cat. I mean, the other thing I'm seeing here, if you want to go a tick above, you got the Compre. Oh, man. Welcome to freaking 2024, Jay. Matt. Hey, guys. Love the show. I was listening to the Read the Water podcast, and you were talking about determining the dominant forage base in a lake. Here's the situation I'm up against in Canada. The lake I fish has a massive population of all of the general forage baits like walleye, perch, crappie, cisco, shad, and other panfish. My question is, how do you narrow down which of the forage the muskies would be likely to chase, follow around the lake as a main food source? Would it be more of a seasonal thing or more like humans when you have a favorite meal at a restaurant? Jay, what's your favorite meal at a restaurant?
perch.
No, it's not. Folks, I took Jay to his first Mexican restaurant 3 years ago. What is a fajita?
I took you to an Italian restaurant. Remember that one?
Oh, I'd been to it. No. Okay, so, yes, Jay, that was my first exposure to Italian food.
It was pretty good.
No, it was...
Okay. Yeah, you ordered a cheeseburger. Okay, you're not supposed to do that there.
I did not. Let me set the scene, folks.
Go ahead.
So, Jay lives in what I call the Northwoods bubble. The Northwoods bubble is just this odd thing. You cannot permeate. You cannot puncture. It is what it is. Me and Jay.
It's ironclad.
It's ironclad. Jay and I are hungry. And the last thing I want is another cheeseburger in my life. I say, let's see what's out there. We go to this restaurant. It's called Spangs, right?
Oh, yeah.
It's like Bangs, but Spangs.
Mm-hmm.
We show up. We check in with the hostess, who is also a waitress, and they said, it'll be a minute, and we're understaffed. That's the nature of the beast. We sit on our table. We order. It is something out of the 1970s at best. Your salad comes in a wooden bowl, and my favorite thing on earth is your salad comes with a side plate. It has a pat of butter for your salad, Jay, mind you, right? And that's for your salad.
It's for the dinner roll, Steve.
There's no dinner roll. There's breadsticks, and they don't bring it with the salad. So on your salad side plate, you get a pat of butter. You get a slice of carrot. You get a raw mushroom. And you get a peppercini. And it's just randomly laying there. The food is delicious. I will say this. If we don't take endorsees on the podcast, but if Spangs want to get in on this shit, I'm in. But the food was great, but it literally, if you're like, had me and Jay left there and gone to a disco after, it would have made sense. It was just 1970s run amok. It was hilarious.
I remember that. That was a great meal. It took so long. They were so busy. That was the night every place in a 15-mile radius of my house was closed.
That was the first night.
In the middle of the summer.
That was the first night you drank a LIT, though.
Was it?
Yeah. Jay was righteously lit, but not bashing the place, but it was so entertaining because so obtusely lost in time. It was so funny.
It was like, a step back in time. It's like, atmosphere, Steve.
You told me we're going to JCPenney's. I need a new pair of pants. We're going to Spangs, and we're going to the discotheque after. That would have been the afternoon. You know, it was freaking hilarious. But nonetheless, what's my favorite food, Jay? You never ask. Gyros. What's my favorite?
Oh, ooh, yeah. Ooh,
we had those.
We had those one night. Yeah. Oof.
Anyway.
Good stuff.
What do you think my favorite food is?
Steak.
No, it's just freaking, that's run of the mill. I love it, but nonetheless, I'm a gyro kind of guy. Can't eat those every day, but a good gyro and me are.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
I've rolled around on Jay's floor covered in tzatziki before. And that's a fact. You've listened to that episode where Jay's like, Steve, drink water, sober up. We got to get this done. So. Done talking about our favorite foods. Do muskies have a preference as far as flavor? It's funny. It's like cyclical. So for a muskie to have a preference versus flavor, I guess he would have to have taste buds. And that would be it. Like, okay, if we're going, I don't like eating those, but I like eating those. Right? I don't think they have the capacity for that. A conversation I had about this week would be like caloric value versus risk, right? So I truly believe the bigger the muskie, the more apt they are to tend towards open water. Because like a Cisco, let's say we get a big Cisco versus a perch, right? A big Cisco is going to have a higher caloric value to its fatty, oily nature.
Oilier.
Than a perch, yeah.
Right.
So I think you're going to see a size class change based on forage more so than a musky preference. Now, what do we often see, Jay? Like, the best way I tried to put it this week, I was talking about. So You pull up in a sloppy weed bed and you throw a small bucktail and you catch a dozen hammer handle pike, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're on something that's about that size. They're eating little perch, little walleye juveniles, right? Whereas you upsize the bait and you're not catching them, but you're catching 40s or 36s and you move out to the deep edge, you flip around, you're seeing bigger fish. You will see a forage size preference, I think, far more than species. Now, I could be wrong on that. I'm willing to be wrong if somebody says, hey, on Georgian Bay, the 55 pluses only eat Ciscos, but the 54s to 52s are eating walleyes, and the 51s to 48s are eating perch. I've yet to see it. I'm willing to go there, right? That's fine.
It's always been my theory about the shallow weed bed fish. Tend to be the smaller ones because they're in there feeding more, and the big ones aren't going to compete with it. And what are they chasing? They're chasing minnows.
At the risk of getting myself in trouble, what do fat people eat, Jay? Pizza, chips, Doritos. I'm getting hungry now, right? Fatty oil. What gets you fat?
Cookies?
Jay, just said your favorite meal, steak. Yes, today I had a steak. I had a baked potato, no salt, sour cream only, no butter. I had a steak with zero seasoning. It was grilled, and it sucked, right?
Oh,
I don't want to get fat, right? Me, no fat. If I wanted to go out and put blue cheese crumbles on it, I'd load the baked potato. You see what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
The more oil, the more fat, the more calories you introduce, the same. Okay. The same meal, if I took a steak, this is a great reference. I'm just making shit up, right? I took the same 74-ounce steak I have for dinner. I take the same 12-ounce steak I have for dinner, right? 12 ounces of steak. And we have two steaks, steak left, steak right. Steak left is the horrible steak that actually she did a great job, but steak left is the Steve Paul boring steak, right? Me no fat fat. When you hit your 40s, you know what I'm talking about. You'll hit the wall. Your life will fall apart. You're in your 20s. You're laughing at me, but screw you, right? So I've got my boring steak. It is meat and heat, right? I got the recipe from the Smitty's. Then I take my steak.
Meat and heat only.
That's how the Smitty's cook.
That's right. That's how they roll, Steve.
Right. They call it Flavor Town. So I've got my left steak, which is grilled. And it is meat, and that is it. We've introduced
the left steak?
Left hand. Okay. I mean, it's an example, Jay. Follow along, if you would.
Yeah. Okay.
Conceptualize.
Visually. Yep.
Right? Mm-hmm. The right steak, both are 12 ounces. We have a 12-ounce steak of her, but we introduce 1 ounce of blue cheese crumbles to the same steak, right?
Mm.
The amount of fat has gone up insanely higher. Right? If we had the same steak, mirror image, same amount of gristle or no gristle, whatever it is, 12 ounces of blue cheese is like over the top amount of fat content. So a 12-inch, and this is a ridiculous example, but just to resonate with people, a 12-inch walleye versus a 12-inch Cisco is a steak with no blue cheese versus a steak with blue cheese, or a dry baked potato versus a loaded baked potato. The caloric value is insanely higher from a fat perspective, right? Well, the thought process is this. You could eat as much protein as you wanted as a human. I don't know if it translates to muskies. Again, I'm willing to be wrong. But you could eat as much just pure protein as you want as a human being, but you will starve to death if you don't have fat. So how much fat do you need proportionally? I personally believe bigger fish need a higher fat content, not only to maintain body weight to maintain their basic size, right? Where I don't think a 55-inch muskie in a shad-based system is going to target a ton of small shad, right? Because how much energy does it take to catch said small bait, right?
That's the thing, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And we're talking this week, and I hope it makes sense. The only way you can sort of make things relevant is trying to dial into our own world where you go, all right, Jay, you know, I'm going to, you can eat as many chicken McNuggets as you want, but they're a mile and a half apart. Eat a chicken McNugget and then go a mile to get your next one.
Yeah, you have to walk to get there too.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You have to crawl, Jay. I walk you through. Okay. But let's say, now, it's a good example just to get the concept in your head. So we go down, say, a track, and for every mile Jay gets a Chicken McNugget, how many miles could you run?
Well, that's the thing. That's how Dick Stemke got the shingles.
And the gout.
Yeah.
You know, you hit them shits with the sweet and sour sauce. You're going to have the gout.
You hit the nail on the head with that one, Steve.
And now your ankles are the size of your wife's ass.
Ouch.
But to think of it conceptually being big fish, big meal, you cannot perpetuate that machine. You cannot, you know, it's all concepts, but, you know, if your truck gets 10 miles a gallon, you can't expect to put, okay, your truck gets 10 miles a gallon, right, Jay? You can't expect to put three quarters of a gallon of gas in and get 11 miles. It's fuel. So fish are seeking a certain level of fuel before they react or don't react. You know, the old adage, the bigger the bait, the bigger the fish, there's a reason that happens. So the bigger the forage, the bigger the fish. Now, the other thing that plays in my mind is availability, right? So the reason I said this stupid obtuse Jay, and Jay's on the high school track. He's got his headband on. Jay, are you there? You're sweating, right? Mm-hmm. He's warmed up. He watched the cheerleaders. He got a restraining order, and he's on the high school track, and he's going to run a mile. So every mile, Jay might theoretically get one Chicken McNugget. So the caloric value of the Chicken McNugget will at some point leave Jay dying on the track. Well, if Jay got a Chicken McNugget every 200 steps, it might be worth his time. So there's a thought process of big fish, mature fish, on readily available small forage in mass quantity. So don't expect dispersed small forage to produce big fish. Readily available, tightly packed small forage will produce big fish. And that's a seasonal aspect, right? So if things are congregated, bait fish are congregated, yeah, big fish will move in. 55s will move in. The Bay of Green, wherever it might be, where I'm at, you might find shad that are 5 inches long and they're juveniles, and there's 52s, 53s, 54s, and they're whacking them left and right. But they're not going to work hard enough to pick those off in a spread out concept, right? So if Jay gets a Chicken McNugget every 300 steps versus every quarter mile, it might be worth his time. If he's getting one every 100 steps, but if he only gets one a mile, what's the caloric risk? What's the caloric reward before that fish? Because I need to turn my attention to something else where my energy, my output is a higher yield, right? So I don't believe that it's a matter of I like walleye, I like shad, I like alewives, I like Cisco's. It's a matter of what's easiest, what's the highest value, and where am I going to be? I don't know. Stupid or not, Jay?
I don't think it's stupid. I agree with that totally.
Well, why are you down at the track stretching right now?
No, that's the thing with big fish, though. The bigger mature fish have a totally different feeding mechanism, I think, on a daily ritual, more or less. And that's the thing. I think I tried tying that in earlier, you know, about small fish and small forage in small containment areas like, you know, weed beds that are fairly congested and the whole thing with, you know, big fish not wanting to compete and expel a ton of energy to try to feed in that situation.
I know.
They will roam more in open water and they'll selectively feed on larger, easy targets that get that caloric reward.
It's like Jay down at the Supper Club. What's the largest, easiest target I can find?
There you go.
Anyway, guys, I'm sorry. It's just a concept. We're trying to pound it home. It's funny when you hit Q&A. Like, there's almost And we don't contrive it, but you're like, man,
there's always one there's that like just a opens thread up the Pandora's box.
Or like the scent thing. There's always a thread here where you can go so far down the rabbit hole. I apologize for the scent rampage. Again, these are things we don't know. If we knew what scent it was, bam, right?
Mm-hmm.
I know as a guide where I go, when do I change up from shad kind of things to walleye-ish kind of things, right? Well, that's because of seasonal movements of my forage fish, where if walleyes are deep in the summer, but the shad are prevalent up top, that's why I'm targeting, and vice versa. So there's a modicum of understanding your waterway while also understanding where we're going, okay, fatties like it fatty, right? What's the fattiest, easiest thing I can get? You know, again, conceptualizing it in your own head. Today, for me, it would be far easier to get off the water. I'm soaking wet, right? It would be easier for me to stop and get a freaking $5 Little Caesars and eat in the truck than go home and eat the steak. A fish doesn't think that way. The vice versa goes, where's the $5 Little Caesars hot and ready, right? What's the easiest? What's the cheapest thing I can get? And I can just knock the out of it. That's why you need to look at things. Easy, fast, accessible. Much like Jay at the Supper Club on a Friday night when the big girls have moved up shallow.
Right.
Absolutely. Jay Bird, say goodnight.
Hey, I want to thank Tom Hanks for swinging by. You're a sport. That was fun.
Everybody, Merry Christmas.
He's buried in the neighborhood. All right, folks. Ladies. Oh, yeah. Because of the photos, I got so sick.